calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, the California Senate just became the first legislative body in the nation, way ahead of the House of Representatives and the Senate at the federal level, to pass a resolution saying no to George Bush's escalation plan. Progressive political organizations pushing state houses across the country to approve resolutions. Resolutions have been introduced in about 20 states. It's from the Progressive States Network and the San Francisco Gate. Interesting. Bush gave a press conference this morning. Some rather strange comments he had to make. We will share them with you as the program goes on. Congressman Lynn Westmoreland, one of the more outrageous comments on the floor of the House yesterday. War in Afghanistan and CNN and the whole media meltdown that's going on this thing, or the media cheerleading it, depending on how it is. But let's take just a momentary break from that and deal with the stuff that actually, I mean, this stuff obviously affects all of us just as well. And yet, one in three Americans will get cancer in their lifetimes. People, you know, going to the doctor is a reality of life. Healthcare is a reality of life. It's a very important part of life. And the United States has the most dysfunctional healthcare system, arguably on Earth, but certainly among the 37 industrialized nations. Highly industrialized nations. Dan Gaynor is with us. He's the director of the Business and Media Institute. Their website, businessandmedia.org, what might be described as a conservative pro-business think tank. Dan, would that be out of line to say that?
Oh, I'd be absolutely willing to say that we're conservative and pro-business, but not so crazy that to say that business never does anything wrong, or you know that government needs to go away entirely or something silly like that.
Yeah. Okay. So credentials established. A conservative who's not crazy. Reminds me of the I don't know if you're old enough to remember the, I think it was 68 election or 72 election. No, it was the 72 election. Nixon was running for office, and there's this guy named Papoon. I think he was down in Texas, and he was running for president, and his slogan was, not insane. And then he was on the bumper stickers, you know, not insane.
Was that Pat Paulson, you mean?
No.
Oh, was that Pat Paulson's slogan? Oh, okay.
No, this was a guy named Papoon, but it's a, you know, kind of an inside joke for old farts. Anyhow, the governor of California has put together a bold and groundbreaking health plan proposal. And Bush has put together a modest overhaul that will provide substantial tax savings. I'm not convinced that either one of these are going to do any good, because they both have the bloodsuckers called the health insurance industry attached to our backs. What's your take on these programs?
Well, I mean, first of all, I know the media's take. The media's take is certainly pro-Schwarzenegger's big government solution to health care. We've been here before. We went through the Hillary care wars, and both sides seem to be willing to wash their hands of any attempt at nationalized health care, because we just look to Canada and say that's not what Americans want, and by and large it's not. Now, the president...
I think it is what Americans want.
What's interesting about the president's plan, though, and I mean, because initially my reaction to the president's plan was somewhat negative, because it does raise taxes on some people. But across the board, conservative groups, tax groups, public policy groups, seem to be supporting the plan for one big reason. It removes the benefit you get if you're, let's say you've got a wonderful plan. Let's say Air America decided to give you know, just the platinum plan for health care, and it'd be worth $20,000.
Well, in my dreams.
I figured that. Removes that benefit that you would get, and that people who don't get government health care don't get. So what it does, it sort of neutralizes out the tax code for health care. And so it uses that money gained to try to help people by offering tax breaks.
But here's a question, Dan. I mean, you know, first of all, Air America does provide health care to their employees, and it's a pretty reasonable plan. As does Clear Channel, who I also work for here in Portland, and I'm using the Clear Channel plan. My producer David is using the Air America plan, and you know, they're both reasonable health insurance programs. But why should there be health insurance companies at all? Why should we be messing around with tax code to encourage people to buy something from a company that, frankly, in my opinion, should not even exist? You got 30 cents out of every healthcare dollar going to the health insurance companies who are not providing services to us. You got guys like William McGuire walking off with a $1.78 billion paycheck. You got guys like Bill Frist's daddy making billions, literally billions, multiple billions of dollars off the privatization of what was a nonprofit industry, hospitals in the United States, and healthcare facilities. And the result is not an increase in quality of care. It's not an increase in the number of people being served. It's an increase in profits for a very small number of people.
Well, why should we have private companies at all? Why should we have Air America and not just have NPR? Why should we?
Because there's a lot of things that private companies do well. When it doesn't have to do with the survival of human beings, when it doesn't have to do with the things that we have in common, where we as a community collectively need to administer it. I don't want the government making my shoes. I'd like to have 100 different companies or 1,000 different companies offering shoes that I can buy. But shoes don't determine whether or not I'm going to live and die.
But I don't want the government making those decisions either. Because the reality is, the reason why healthcare is so expensive now is because of government intervention.
It's because of the profits that are being made by the healthcare industry, and you know it, Dan.
Profits
look at
are
the,
not
this
a
is
bad
the,
thing. You don't. But I mean.
But that's why it's so expensive. Is because those profits in the abstract are not a bad thing. Profits on our lives are a bad thing.
Remember, you made a historical reference. Remember back into the 70s, and when you used to have health care plans, they were very basic. Small business people, and you know this, you were a small businessman. Small business people could buy a slimmed-down health care plan.
I was able to offer a comprehensive Blue Cross Blue Shield to my employees back in the 1970s for about $35 per person per
right,
month.
Right, the comprehensive yeah, back then.
But back then, Blue Cross Blue Shield was required by state law in the state of Michigan, where I was doing business, to be a not-for-profit corporation. And they were not interested in sucking an additional 10 or 20% off the top so that they could pay huge salaries to their CEOs, so they could have gold-plated faucets in the bathroom of the corporate jet, so they could do all kinds of marketing and advertising, and so that they could pay 10% dividends to their stockholders.
Back then, they also weren't bullied into paying for in vitro fertilization, acupuncturists, chiropractors, everything under the sun. Unfortunately, and this is a horrible reality for Americans.
So you don't think the health insurance companies should be bullied into providing us with the health care that we want?
I don't think they should be bullied into providing us with infinite health care, because there is a limit. Suppose you and I are part of a plan and we both have rare diseases that are going to cost $100 million to cure, but they could be cured. Should that health care plan pay for it?
Well, this is why if you have 320 million people or whatever the population of the United States is now, depending on you know, how you define it and whether or not you count immigrants, but if you have over 300 million people in the plan, then all those things even out. Right now you don't. You
no,
have about
don't
two
even out because healthcare spending is up because we do have the most sophisticated medical opportunities in this country in the world.
People we do not. We're 27 in infant mortality in the world. We're in the 20s by virtually any measure. We have lower life expectancy than most industrialized countries. We have lower infant mortality. We have a terrible healthcare system
no,
in this
country.
We
also have higher technology, better drugs. I mean, who manufactures the drugs of the world? It's American companies, by and large.
And German, by and large, American companies owned by the Germans or the Swiss, and a lot of those drugs are manufactured, or the patents are coming out of Germany and Switzerland, out of Europe. France, for example, one of the largest, you know, owns one of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world. No, I don't buy it, Dan. I'm sorry. And in fact, the last time I was in a hospital, I got a CAT scan on a machine that was made in Germany. The MRI was made in Japan.
And where did that technology come from originally?
Well, maybe Germany and Japan.
I mean, the reason why
where they have national health care programs.
Clearly, Americans have spoken that they don't want a nationalized health care plan.
They have not. They were bamboozled into that thing with those Harry and Louise ads that the health insurance industry ran, saying, "Do you want the government deciding what doctor you can go to?" And within 1 year of those ads running, the health insurance company started telling us what doctor we could go to. We were lied to, Dan.
Nobody tells me what doctor I can go to. I mean, I have a fairly typical medical plan. Nobody tells me.
You don't have doctors that are in your plan and outside your plan?
Oh, but I can choose to go outside my plan. I do. For my eye doctor is outside my plan. So go to my eye doctor, but go in for 20 years.
Do you pay more?
They underwrite 50% of it.
Yeah, so there you go. I mean, if you're not a, you know, a wealthy guy like Dan Gaynor, you don't
not
have
a wealthy
choice.
I work for a nonprofit, just as you work for Air America. Yeah. Neither one of us is raking in the huge bill. The problem, if you ask Americans, do they want socialized medicine, the answer is across the board no.
No, but the answer is yes. If you ask Americans if they think that that Medicare should be applied to everybody in the United States, which is not socialized medicine, single payer, they say yes. Look at the polls. More than 80% of Americans.
By and large, if you go for a nationalized health care plan, you're going to have government making this even worse, mandating horrible things that are going to hurt business and industry. And across the board, because this would affect all companies, it's going to hurt business and industry across the board.
Okay, I'll give you the last word. Dan Gaynor, he's the director of the Business and Media Institute, businessandmedia.org. Dan, thanks for being with us today.
It's always a pleasure, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
We're privatizing Medicare, it's history, and what will take its place will be a prime example of truly ample opportunity. Oh, there's a hefty deductible on all the drugs you need. And there's co-payments for sure, we're selling a cure if you're feeding my greed. Oh, Grandma, sign the paper. Grandpa, don't be slow, yes, you'll get medication if you join our HMO.
And welcome back, talking back to the mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, noon to three Eastern Time, live, Tom Hartman here with you. And in fact, have you noticed? I mean, the song obviously was a pastiche, but have you noticed how the pharma, the trade organization for the big drug companies, the one that Billy Towson, the guy who shepherded the Medicare Part D program through Congress, pushed in that donut hole and made it so that the big part of it was that it was illegal for the government to negotiate drug prices. He had to get a special exemption to leave Congress before his term was out so that he could take his $1 or $2 million a year salary with pharma. They're now running these ads on TV saying, our Medicare program is working. Let's just give it a chance. Everything is just fine, paid for by pharma. And everybody's going, pharma? Who's pharma? I don't know what pharma is. It must be the government. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. So the good news, I guess, on the health care front. And by the way, our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. And just a heads up, on Monday of next week, it's going to change. We're going to be we'll be using the phone number that the rest of the Air America hosts use that Al Franken had been using. You may want to just put that in your bio computer, and I will give you that number on Monday when we start out, although it's the normal Air America number. But until Monday, our telephone number, 866-440-THOM. And TomHartman.com, of course, is not going to change. And if you want to drop into our live chat room and hang out with some of the finest minds in the entire universe, well, at least in the Internet. Well, at least in our chat room. No, actually, on the Internet, yes. Just click TomHartman.com, and up at the top, it's his live chat. You can drop in there, and it's real easy. Anyhow, here's the news. This is from Reuters today in the Washington Post. A group of 10 senators, led by Senator Ron Wyden, the Democrat of Oregon, one of my senators, wrote to Bush offering to work with him on legislation and citing an urgent need to deal with the problem of surging health costs. Further delay, said the letter from these 10 senators, the primary author Ron Wyden, further delay is unacceptable. As costs continue to skyrocket, our population ages and chronic illnesses increase. In addition, our businesses, and this is a biggie, I mean, all these guys talk about, it's going to hurt business. Well, I'm sorry, business is being hurt by a health care program that's based on business paying the bill. They say, in addition, our businesses are at a severe disadvantage when their competitors in the global market get health care for free. Obviously, it's not free, but it is to the businesses. You know, our employer-based health care program really came about as a fluke. It was after World War II. There was a tremendous demand for labor because so many of our young men and a few of our young women, but particularly our young men who comprised most of the labor force in the United States, at least the industrial labor force in the United States, had died in Europe and in Asia in World War II. And so we had the American economy going through a massive boom, a huge explosion, and at the same time, there weren't that many workers. And so the big auto companies in particular, but, you know, other industries as well, they had to figure out a way to compete for workers, and they didn't want to raise wages. Actually, in some cases, during World War II, they couldn't, because there were these wage and price controls that were meant to relatively stabilize the U.S. economy during a time of just absolute wild swings worldwide as a consequence of the war. And so companies couldn't raise wages. But they wanted to compete with each other to get the best workers. So they started offering other kinds of benefits like pensions and health care. And of course, you know, leading that charge in negotiating those benefits were the unions. God bless them. I mean, we had 35% of the American workforce unionized during and immediately after World War II. And so the unions were out there saying, yeah, you know, you're paying us a decent wage and a single person can raise a family, put their kids through school. You can save for a vacation, all that kind of stuff. That's all fine. That's all well and good. But we would also like fully paid health insurance without deductibles, without anything. In fact, I remember as a 6-year-old, 7-year-old, now this was in the 1950s, my dad working in a tool and die shop in Lansing, Michigan, and I remember the doctor coming to our house. I honest to God, I remember when they did house calls. I mean, that, you know, it was the hospitals were not for profit. The Blue Cross Blue Shield plan that my dad had through the union, through the tool and die shop, was non-profit. They paid for everything. And, you know, it seemed like a good idea back then to have the employers pay for the health insurance and took the pressure off government. Although Harry Truman in 1947 did propose a national health care system, a Medicare for all. But the Republicans in Congress refused to even vote on it. I mean, they shot that thing down. They took control of the Congress in the election of 46. Republicans were always opposed to big government solutions. So we had employers doing it. So now we have American employers at a terrible disadvantage with other employers all over the world who don't have to pay this much. I mean, you had Toyota, I believe it was, relocate a car plant that they were thinking of buying from Alabama to Canada because there's more health care cost in a car than steel. 27 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls.
Listening to you, I get the music. Gazing at you, I get the heat. Following you, I climb the mountain. I get excitement at your feet.
And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Speaking of health care, this is an issue that is not often discussed other than, you know, little 3-inch articles in the newspaper, but I think, frankly, is a really important one and should have been getting a whole lot more press for a lot of years. This story, for example, Dateline San Francisco, AIDS patient suffering from debilitating nerve pain got as much or more relief by smoking marijuana as they would typically get from prescription drugs and with fewer side effects, according to a study conducted under rigorously controlled conditions with government-grown pot. In a 5-day study performed in a specially ventilated hospital ward, gee, I wonder why, where patients smoked 3 marijuana cigarettes a day, more than half the participants tallied significant reductions in pain. In contrast, less than 1/4 of those who smoked placebo pot, which had its primary psychoactive ingredients removed, reported benefits as measured by subjective pain reports and standardized neurological tests. The White House belittled the study. That should make us all furious. But other doctors and advocates of marijuana policy reform said the findings in today's issue of the journal Neurology offer powerful evidence of the value of pot for pain with AIDS patients. Now, of course, the White House belittled it. It was published in the journal Neurology. It's science. Good heavens, we can't have that. And then this from Michael Doyle, the McClatchy Tribune News Service. The medical researchers need more marijuana sources because government supplies are not meeting scientific demand, a federal judge has ruled. In a non-binding opinion, the Drug Enforcement Administration's judge is recommending that a University of Massachusetts professor be allowed to grow a legal marijuana crop. Administrative Law Judge Mary Ellen Bittner ruled that the existing supply of marijuana is not adequate. Why don't we just decriminalize this stuff? I mean, this is nuts. And then let some, you know, let some decent researchers do some decent research and pull out the active ingredient and make it into a pill. And yeah, some drug company can make money on it, no problem. And you know, what difference does it make what people are doing in their own private home, as long as they're not driving down the street stoned? This is, it's, anyhow, that's not health care, and that's another rant. Carl in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Carl, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Looking into your program and have some comments about, you know, the cost of health care. I don't think that you can point to any one thing that's increasing health care costs. There's a lot of things. I am in the healthcare industry. I'm a pharmacist. But ultimately, we're using a lot more healthcare than we ever have in the past. I think a lot of it is attributed to our lifestyles as Americans. We eat poor food. We exercise less. We're obese. We're getting diabetes. You know, we are reducing our smoking rates a little bit. That helps a lot.
Yeah, we get rid of smoking. We replace it with corn syrup.
Where are we going there? If the insurance companies are making 30%, I think that's egregious. I think it's outstanding. You know, could it be all the drug companies? I don't think so. Is it all the pharmacists? Is it all the providers? No, but we're utilizing more. Now, I don't know. I'm not an expert at this.
But we're not utilizing more at a rate that's any different than any of the other industrialized countries, particularly those of Europe, that experienced the same baby boom that we did, that have the same demographic that we do. And, you know, yeah, they're tweaking their systems as time goes on, but they're not having the crisis that we're having. They're not paying $5,600, between $5,000 and $6,000 per person per year for health care like we do here, and they are covering 100% of their people.
Well, I don't know. I couldn't comment on that. I just know that at least the insurance industry, I remember in the 80s when the old system was, you know, the fee for service, you go see your doctor, that you pay them, you pay them, or somebody pays them on a regular fee for service basis. Then the HMOs came to keep us healthy to try to reduce utilization. I don't think that ever really worked out all that well. And it's this whole evolution of the insurance industry and how big it's getting. And they're really only supposed to be adjudicating our claims, making sure that...
Well, and some of that actually worked out fairly well in the early days. I remember back in the late 70s, I got to know Ben Feingold quite well, and he was working out of Kaiser in San Francisco. Kaiser was a nonprofit then, and they were a real leader in preventative health care and keeping people healthy.
There's a lot going on in Minnesota, too. Midwest, they did a lot. And if you could really have the whole team working together, the whole healthcare team, the pharmacist, the doctor, the nurse working to keep these people
healthy. But see, here's the thing, Carl. As long as the people who are making the decisions at the top, who are determining what the nurse-patient ratio is going to be, for example, in the hospital, or who are determining what pharmaceuticals are going to be used, or who are determining, you know, what surgery is appropriate when and what kind of healthcare, all those kinds of decisions, as long as their prime motive is to increase profit and satisfy stockholders, you're not going to have the best healthcare system in the world. Their prime motive has to be delivering the best healthcare, and you only get that with not-for-profit organizations. I'm not saying it has to be government-run, but you get that with not-for-profit organizations. And that's why hospitals were not-for-profit in virtually every state in the country for well over a century, up until Reagan came along and started changing, encouraging the change of those laws.
Yeah, I'd say that most, just stepping back with, you know, physicians and such, most people want the most appropriate care. They don't want overutilization, but they don't want underutilization, because underutilization is going to cost us money down the road.
Right, exactly. Now, we've got to come up with a rational basis. Carl, I've got to move along. I appreciate the call, though. Thank you very much. Some good points, and you clearly thought this stuff through. Steve in Port Orchard, Washington. Hey, Steve.
Yeah, hi, how are you, Tom? You got a great program here.
Thank you.
You know, we need a single-payer healthcare system. I was talking to my doctor the other day, my annual physical, and he even admitted it. You know, we've got so many people uninsured. You know, this Dan Gaynor is probably a nice guy, but, you know, it seemed to me that you kind of ate his lunch in that debate. You threw these statistics at him, and you just didn't get an answer. Just one other comment, and then I'll hang up and you can make whatever comment you want to make, but conservatives frustrate me in this issue because they're so negative. You know, you never hear anything from them positive about any other healthcare system like Canada. Well, here's one for you. A customer of mine the other day was telling me about how her husband was from Canada and needed a liver transplant. And by the time the whole thing was said and done, cost about $1 million. Didn't cost him anything out of his pocket, you know, other than his, of course, medical premiums. I wonder how many Walmart workers or people without insurance or even even people in our country that have somewhat of a medical plan could handle an expense like that. And I'll take the comment off the air. But good show.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for your comments. No, you're absolutely right. It's huge. And the transplants are one of the areas where it's really becoming visible. I mean, we live in a country where you go into the 7-Eleven, the local convenience store, and there's a can there with a picture of a 10-year-old kid who needs a kidney, and you're asked to put a quarter in it because they've got to raise $100,000. I mean, what is wrong with this picture? At what point are Americans going to say, hey, wait a minute, this is not the America that we thought we bought into or that we were born into? Mike in Westminster, South Carolina. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom. It's good to talk to you again. Hey, I'm also in the healthcare business. I work for Eastman Kodak, and we're in the medical imaging business. Of course, our business is being sold to a Canadian company. It's another part of the sellout of America.
Sure.
Yeah, many of the employees.
Gotta balance that trade deficit.
Yeah, exactly right. That money's got to come back in here somewhere. And, you know, all of the employees that work for us are getting our retirement health benefits cut. They're not going to.
Isn't it ironic that a Canadian company is buying you, but they're not giving you a Canadian health care program?
That's really interesting, isn't it? But you hit the nail right on the head on all of these things that you were talking about earlier. And the fact of the matter is, the insurance companies in America don't have any business in this system at all because they're not in the business of delivering health care. They're not even in the business of paying for health care. They're in the business of not paying for health care because it drives the corporate profits up.
That's right. They have phone banks. They have rooms full of people whose job is to say no. They don't. At the first two tiers, they don't even have the ability to say yes. They only have the ability to say no.
Right.
And finally, it gets up to a supervisor who has the ability to say yes.
Yeah.
And their job is to try and prevent as many payments as possible. Good point, Mike. Thank you very much. Good to hear from you. John in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, John.
Last week on, I think it was ABC Evening News, there was a doctor saying that if you go to a hospital in the United States, you're more liable to die than you will if you go in a car crash or a drug overdose. He was saying
25% of all hospital deaths are what are called iatrogenic, which is a fancy word for doctor or hospital caused. So there is some cause for concern there. On the other hand, there are some services you can get in a hospital that you can't get at the 7-Eleven. You know, so sometimes you have no choice.
You know, about this profit thing, though. I had a friend of mine about 5 years ago. He was on prescription drugs. I think it was probably Vicodin or Oxycontin. He didn't really tell me. Well, they put him on methadone. And he, for 5 years, his whole life was around every other day getting the methadone clinic.
Oh, yeah. Methadone is nasty, nasty stuff.
And it was $100 a week. Anyway, he committed suicide 2 weeks ago. Like, I'm really distraught now. But I'm finding all this out. Oh, my brother's on methadone. Ina Nicole, they opened up a refrigerator. There was a bottle of methadone. Her son committed suicide.
You know, Hitler took methadone. It was invented by the Nazi scientists as a painkiller, and Hitler was taking methadone and amphetamines. And it's just a really nasty drug. When I was a teenager, I had some friends who were heroin addicts and who were taking methadone, and they found it was harder to kick the methadone than the heroin.
Well, I talked to Chris before he killed himself. He told me he was going to commit suicide because of the pain. He told me he couldn't go to the bathroom, he couldn't move. I thought he was exaggerating. His wife called me the next day and said he took a gun, and he's a liberal, and he shot himself.
Yeah.
So much for our healthcare system.
At least in England, heroin is legal. I think heroin is a more benign drug than methadone, frankly. But methadone is profitable to the health insurance industry because it's legal, it's out there, and all that kind of thing. So,
hey, they put that John Bortz over here. Neil Bortz even said that he'd rather smoke marijuana than do Oxycontin. He was going to have an operation.
Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't believe when I heard him say it.
Well, you know, common sense doesn't have a political label attached to it. John, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where smart people get their news. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this.
Slow train coming down that freedom track. Slow train coming on down that freedom track. Don't need money in your sack, fancy suit on your back. Ride the slow train.
And welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 866-440, Tom, T-H-O-M. And the website, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Ted driving in Vermont. Hey, Ted, what's on your mind today?
Hello?
Hey, Ted. You are live on the air, sir. Yeah, yeah, indeed.
Oh, hey, Tom, how's it going?
Great, great. What's up?
Well, the comment that I wanted to make was the commercials that you see for the prescription-only drugs and how out of balance it is and where are we supposed to get good information. The one that I find the most egregious recently is the one that uses the penguins dancing and talks about flu medicine and then says to go to a website to get more facts. I'm not even going to say what the website is. I don't want to give them any free advertising, but
yeah.
There's got to be a different way to do advertising about drugs that...
Well, it used to be banned. We used to simply say if it's a prescription drug, you know, the assumption is that a doctor is the one who needs to be making the decision about whether a person should be taking it. You shouldn't be encouraging people to take it. And they were banned. It was against the law to advertise prescription drugs. And, you know, they got that law changed with a whole lot of lobbying. And now, and, you know, keep in mind, most of the research that's done on new pharmaceuticals, on the truly new pharmaceuticals, not the let's change three molecules so that we can extend the patent for another 10 years, but the truly new pharmaceuticals, is federally funded. It's paid for with your and my tax dollars. And, the amount of money that these guys are spending on advertising just to drive up profits, and, of course, they're only advertising the most highly profitable drugs. They're not advertising the generics and things like that, is nuts. It's obscene. It's absurd. I agree with you, Ted, and I think that we should go back to saying prescription drugs should not be advertised on television, or period. They should not be, you can advertise them to the trade. You can advertise them to physicians, but that's it. Ted, good point. Well made. Thank you for the call. George in Naperville, Illinois. Hey, George.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. First,
Sure. Congratulations
on being Al Franken's replacement.
Well, thank you.
Looking forward to that.
I'm looking forward to on Monday we'll be on a whole bunch more stations. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, I'm calling about the Medicare replacement policies.
Mm-hmm.
But first, in between, I heard you talking about house calls, you know, in your dad's day. Just wanted, you know, I'm a clinical psychologist, neuropsychologist, and I'm opening up a practice component here where I'm going to make house calls.
That's Medicare. Great.
I mean, about the blizzard and the cold weather around here. And,
sure.
And I've already gotten some referrals from my own doctor, who I told.
That's great.
And Medicare gives you no problem about covering that. You know, you just list yourself as making house calls, and they treat it like if you see them in the hospital or in your own office.
Yeah, it's just a little less efficient. You can't stack them up and make quite as much money.
Right. Well,
but if you're really concerned about caring for the patient, then
exactly.
And it's the best thing for the patient, God bless you. That's
great. Well, we're about the same age, and I'm slowing down my myself, so that I just want to have a nice little cottage practice here. But
that's
the
cool.
Medicare, you know, patients who have the Medicare replacements think that there's actually no difference. You know, that's the way it's sold on TV and, and brochures. When on a previous call I pointed out that, you know, we're actually subsidizing the profit margin, you know, for the company. But the point
right.
I want to make is...
And Medicaid as well.
Yes. But with Medicare, well, when you contract with Medicare, I'm required in my profession to accept Medicare assignment. That is, you know, less than what I normally would charge, but what Medicare assigns. And I'm willing to do that. That, you know, it's part of the commons, as you say.
Right.
But, and these replacement policies pay according to assignment. But I don't have a contract with them. Right?
Mm.
So what I'm planning on doing is first check into the legality of this to see if I'm allowed to charge my regular bill, you know, if they have Medicare replacement, and not to hold the patient accountable. That's not the point. I won't
right.
do that. But to write a letter saying, you know, just to educate the patients that there is a difference. You know, you and I are subsidizing this your insurance policy's profits. You know, and by the way, we can charge you, you know, for the rest of the bill. Well, we're not, but we could. So, you know, just to educate them as to the difference between Medicare replacement and actual Medicare.
Yeah, good point. Good point, George. And good luck. How it works out.
Well, actually, I've gotten good of the people I've talked to verbally. And the other people are no fools, Tom. They know what's going on.
They
just think that they fall for a sales pitch to save a few extra dollars a month. You know, once you point out the difference, you know,
Well, and you've got millions of dollars being spent on television advertising. You've got ads in all these publications. You've got the American Association of Retired Persons, which is actually health it's actually an insurance company.
Well, one quick example, Tom. Last March, we had a patient in the hospital, had an 80-something-year-old lady, had a stroke, known to us. billed, got her okay after rehab, got her home, Medicare paid, and then I get a notice later on from Medicare saying that this lady had to switch the Medicare replacement the month before. Paperwork hadn't caught up. So I had to reimburse Medicare and bill, the insurance company. Yeah. It took me, I just got the check from an insurance company this month from last March, and I talked to three different states, Massachusetts, Florida, and Texas. You got all these employees, set up to run interference, not to mention supervisors who never call you back. That costs a lot of money.
Yeah, it does. And you know who that money's going to.
And you know where it's coming from.
Yeah, exactly. It's coming from us, and it's going to the stockholders and the corporations that are not providing health services like you are, George, but instead are out there just, basically shuffling paper from side to side. George, thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you. We still have we're slammed here with calls, folks who wanting to talk about health care and these issues. We will continue this conversation after the news at the top of the hour, as well as a few other items of the day. George W. Bush had his news conference. There's some interesting things going on the Iran side. One of the folks in the chat room actually pointed out, did you know that all of Europe and the Middle East, they put, the way that they do dates is day, month, year. Here in the United States, we do month, day, year. And these so-called weapons from Iran are done using the American system, their dates, not done using the European system. Very strange. 57 minutes past the hour.
To the Tom Hartman program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program, the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America. It was Europe's worst terror attack in more than 15 years. Bombs made of dynamite, nails that ripped through four packed Madrid commuter trains, killing 191 people. Remember this? This is, what was the date? March 11th, 2004. Well, the citizens, the good citizens of Spain said, okay, we've been attacked by terrorists. So how are we going to respond to this? And they put together a good, solid police action, and they went out and they arrested people. What a novel idea. I mean, Osama bin Laden's still running around loose. To the best of my knowledge, there hasn't been a single trial of anybody involved in 9/11 yet. Maybe I'm missing something here. I mean, we know that these guys were taking flight training. We know where they were living. We know who, I mean, there's a lot of what we know. We know that ISI, Pakistani intelligence, wired Mohammed Atta $100,000. We know that bin Laden's brother was having lunch with George Bush Sr. The morning of 9/11. I mean, there's a lot of stuff laying around there. As far as I know, no serious investigations, no prosecutions. No, instead our response, instead of using the tools of police power and international police power, instead of reaching out to the police departments of the world and the nations of the world talking about the rule of law, the Taliban was saying, okay, if Osama bin Laden's behind this, we will hand him over. We will arrest him and hand him over to a third country if they guarantee that he'll get a fair trial. And Bush said, nope, we don't want to deal with this by legal process. We want to start a war. So here now in Spain, this is the Associated Press article by Paul Maven and Mar Roman. 29 suspects will be tried in a heavily guarded secure compound. The seven main accused each face up to 40 years in prison if convicted of involvement in the March 11, 2004 attack. The seven leaders a Tunisian, an Algerian, and five Moroccans will never see a courtroom because they blew themselves up. 3 weeks after the bombing, as police closed in on their hideout in the Madrid suburb of Lejeunes. But again, it was the police moving in on them. I don't know if you saw the story. I think it was Saturday. It might have been in the Sunday paper that the Bin Laden trail has gone cold, according to the CIA. They have no idea where he is now. They used to think they knew where he was in Pakistan. They don't even have a clue now. The top defendants, Moroccans Abdelmejad Bouchar and Jamal Zougon, both accused of planting some of the 10 bombs that exploded in backpacks that day. And Youssef Beljad, one of those believed to have direct links to radical groups in Europe. Beljad was arrested in Belgium nearly a year after the attacks. And prosecutors say they have evidence that he made such key decisions as picking the day of the attack and giving the plotters last-minute instructions. Four other men faced the maximum sentence, including Spaniard Emilio Trashoras, a former miner who is accused of supplying the dynamite, and Egyptian Rabbi Osman, arrested in Italy in 2004 and considered one of the masterminds of the attacks. All have pled not guilty. They're going to get a trial. One of the country's top anti-terrorism police officials during the investigation has told the Associated Press that the case against the men includes witness testimony, fingerprints, and other forensic evidence, as well as information culled from computer hard disks. Officials expect the trial to stretch until June and involve testimony from more than 500 witnesses. This is what we did with Tim McVeigh. We had a religious fanatic who, in the name of Jesus Christ, blew up the Oklahoma City building on the second anniversary of the tragic meltdown down in Waco, Texas. And he thought he was going to cause an uprising of good, solid Christian, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Christians, for that matter. He didn't like Catholics much either. All across the United States. He thought that by blowing up the federal bill, he had been reading the Turner Diaries. He had read it several times. It was like his Bible, Tim McVeigh. Gore Vidal interviewed him, wrote a fascinating book about this. Tim McVeigh thought that he was going to create a new America. He thought that he saw himself as a patriot. He thought that as somebody who was disgusted by the direction the country was going because we were not sufficiently Christian. This guy was a religious fanatic. Just like Osama bin Laden is a religious fanatic. And the best way to deal with these guys is not by deifying them, not by putting them up on a pedestal like George Bush did with Osama bin Laden. I mean, he did that because it gave Bush so much more power. You know, keep in mind, Superman would be a very boring guy if there wasn't Lex Luthor. Oh, look at that. He stopped another bank robbery. So what? You can't have a superhero without a super antihero. You've got to have a supervillain. And so Bush made the cynical decision to exploit this situation, this disaster of 9/11, and instead of going after the perpetrators, like Bill Clinton found the guys who blew up the World Trade Center in 93 or tried to, they're sitting in prison right now. Instead, I mean, Osama bin Laden is free. He's running around loose. It is a real tragedy. It is a real tragedy. Let's take it as we continue this conversation and get to your calls and continue with the topic of health care if you'd like. There's some things going on with Iran and Iraq and also the media that I would like to get to as well this hour. But first, let's just take a quick look at what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the cannons. And there is blood on the wire.
The following are security developments in Iraq as of 13:30 GMT on Wednesday. These compiled by Reuters. Dateline Ramadi, a suicide bomber, killed at least 5 people and wounded 20 others when he blew up his vehicle at the entrance of a police station in the western Iraqi city of Ramadi. In Baghdad, a car bomb near a hospital killed 4 people and wounded 10 others in the mainly Christian Camp Sara district of Baghdad. In Baghdad, a roadside bomb targeting a police patrol killed a man and wounded three others in the Al-Sulak district of northern Baghdad. That's interesting, by the way. There's a mainly Christian district in Baghdad. In our good buddy Saudi Arabia, you can be executed for having a Bible. Anyhow, a Dateline Baghdad, a car bomb killed two people and wounded seven others in a market in southern Bayah district of Baghdad. In Baghdad, several mortar rounds killed one person and wounded 16 others in the northern Rashid suburb. In Mosul, a car bomb killed three people and wounded 20 others. In Baghdad, a roadside bomb targeting an Iraqi army patrol killed a civilian in the western Yarmouk district. In Baghdad, clashes erupted between gunmen and the Iraqi army, wounding three soldiers in the Yarmouk district. And in Samawa, gunmen killed a policeman on Tuesday in that southern city 170 miles south of Baghdad. Amazing. It's tragic. And here we have the House of Representatives having a debate right now. Now, you know, Peter DeFazio has actually introduced legislation saying, enough already, let's start cutting back on the money. Let's get control under this. And particularly if this guy thinks that he has authorization to go into Iran, he's sadly mistaken. He no longer even has authorization to continue in Iraq. This is inconsistent with the original authority that we gave him, Congressman Peter DeFazio of Oregon. But what's being debated right now, or discussed, everybody has 5 minutes in the House of Representatives, is whether or not they should issue a statement that they're issuing a statement. It's like, what's wrong with this picture? And the Senate, they were not even allowed by the Republicans in the Senate to have a debate about whether they'd have a debate. They were not even whether they'd issue a non-binding resolution. I think frankly, in my mind, it is so important that we be contacting our elected officials, the people that we put into office, and all up and down the food chain, by the way. I would be contacting my local Democratic Party, my local Republican Party, if I was a Republican or a Green or a Libertarian, whatever you may be. Contact the local folks, contact your elected officials at the state level, at the county level, at the municipal level, and at the federal level. You know, we have municipalities around the United States that are passing resolutions saying, you know, Bush shouldn't be doing this war. We should not be continuing this war. And, of course, the toll-free number for Congress, 866-220-0044. And you can find the regular number for Congress on our homepage at tomharbin.com. Our phone number, 866-440-THOM, tomharbin.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. 16 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman program, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice, the Tom Hartman radio program. Jim in San Francisco, you want to take me on about methadone?
Yeah, you know, it's totally irresponsible of you to, equate methadone with Hitler. I'm a chronic pain patient, and methadone has saved my life, and it's saved thousands of other people's life, whether it's chronic pain or heroin addiction. You're just spouting hearsay from junkies is irresponsible, you know, and you're also always spouting about your Christian values. You know, you ought to grow up someday and stop believing in fairy tales.
Okay.
You know, I mean, you're just totally irresponsible.
Two separate issues. First of all, Jim, if methadone
you know nothing about methadone, you're not a doctor, and you're not a patient. I've been on it for over 10 years, and it has saved my life. Equating it with Hitler is just irresponsible. So I don't want to hear none of your stupid socialist BS. You know, okay. I'm my brother's keeper and all that. That is just way out of line. You know, it's a typical Christian
Jim,
believer like you. You know, I don't want to hear any of your BS. You know,
all right, great. Then you don't have to. Thanks a lot, Jim, for the call. Let me just say, for the record, what I thought I said before. Methadone is a very effective pain reliever. There are a number of very effective pain relievers out there. And methadone is more addictive than heroin. Look it up. And I don't believe that methadone is a useful way for heroin addicts to be weaned off heroin and be put on a pharmaceutical that's, you know, profitable to the drug industry. Bill Call was a dear friend of mine for many years. I watched him struggle with heroin addiction on and off for probably the better part of 6 or 7 years. He would get clean from time to time, and finally he got on methadone. He could not kick methadone. I mean, it was just, and he wasn't the only person that I saw go through this. And he ended up killing himself. This was, you know, 25 years ago or thereabouts. But and the British looked at this and they said, rather than giving methadone to junkies, let's just give heroin to junkies. And what you find, and there's been some very good documentaries done on this. The BBC did an excellent documentary on it that I saw about 3 years ago. And it should be fairly easy to find on the web these days. Is that about 50% of all the heroin addicts in England who are getting legal heroin quit using it spontaneously. It's much harder to do that with methadone. But if you're taking it for chronic pain, God bless you. I mean, you know, people who have chronic pain, addiction should not even be an issue. But if it's for a heroin addict, I just think that, you know, trading in one addictive drug for another is I think that, frankly, we should do what England did, and that is make heroin a pharmaceutical that doctors can prescribe and you know, just go ahead with it like that to work with heroin addicts, quite simply. Anyhow, Scott in Seattle. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I wanted to give a little perspective about the health care and the for-profit thing. I worked for one of those HCA hospitals, which at the time I didn't know was run by the Funky Frisk family. But, yeah, you were right about that. I mean, their motive, bottom line motive is for-profit. And I worked in the accounting department. I worked in the accounts payable department. And it just seemed like, you know, every time around month end, you know, they want to know why this expense is more than that, and, you know, what can we do to increase profit? And it's,
right,
you know, almost
like, because Bill Frist needed some money to run for the Senate, you know.
And, you know, it's almost like, you know, they were encouraging us to go out and make people sick or break legs to get people into their hospital. And, it, you know, and it was so bad, and, you know, the pay was not good. They overworked their nurses. The nurses were leaving in droves. I mean, they offered, you know, bonuses, several thousands of dollars in bonuses to find nurses in specialized fields and stuff to get them in there to work because they couldn't get nurses in there to work. I mean, yeah. Just their motive was just profit and nothing else.
Yeah, indeed. And that's the problem. I mean, we need to say it's fine that you operate a separate non-governmental organization to provide hospital services, for example, but it has to be a not-for-profit corporation. Get a decent board of directors together, people who really care about it, provide the service, and do it. Scott, thank you for an eloquent commentary. Glenn in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Glenn, we have about a minute. What's up?
We switched health insurance plans at the university. This is a well-known private university this year, from one that was kind of crappy anyway to a well-known one. And they said certain things were, everything was covered as on the formulary. When I tried to get my ADHD medication, it took over a month to get an answer out of them that it was contractually excluded by the university. And migraine medication was cut from $9 a month for $35 to $4 a month for $50. And when my wife said, well, where is this list? Because we were told in the meeting there weren't anything excluded. It's all in the formulary, and Adderall was on the formulary. She said, there is, you can't have the list. She said, I can tell you individual drugs, but you can't have the list. It was crazy.
Amazing. So, well, in a way, it gets back to the old thing of, you know, don't listen to what a salesperson says. Look at what the contract says. But you're saying the contract, they wouldn't even give you the contract.
They won't even give us the list of drugs that are excluded or quantities limited.
See, that's such a great example of how terribly broken our system is. Glenn, thank you for the call, and I'm sorry to hear about the situation that you're facing. I know you'll make the best of it. 27 minutes past the hour, and we all need to make the best of it by changing this broken system here on the Tom Hartman Program. And welcome back. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting for a Change. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Dan in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Well, you're not only intelligent, but very bright, man. I'm just very appreciative to be able to talk to you. I'm on methadone and with extreme pain, and without that unretractable pain, I probably couldn't survive, and yet I wish that I could get off of it. My brother was a heroin addict for about 17 years, and finally he kicked it on his own. And
as
he,
most do, actually.
Yeah, pardon me?
Most do. Most heroin. This is the. This is what came out of the British studies, and frankly, the you know the anecdotal American studies is that most people just kick heroin eventually on their own. If it doesn't, you know,
well,
they don't die of it.
He pleaded with me to just not take the methadone because of you know the the problem with it. And also, I was a hospice volunteer. And I had patients that had AIDS and all different kinds of things, and they took the Marinol, the synthetic pill that for in place of marijuana, because one fellow or several fellows couldn't eat.
Yeah,
and
THC
once they
pill.
Took that, they were their appetite picked up immediately.
Yeah, exactly. I have no opposition to the medical use of methadone as a painkiller.
No.
You know, if it's a successful painkiller, I think it's a wonderful thing. I just think that it shouldn't. I don't think any of the synthetic painkillers should be used to treat opiate withdrawal. As I said, I think that you know heroin addicts should deal with heroin. I mean, and let them wean off heroin. But I'm not saying that as the caller who took me to task. I'm not saying that as a physician or as an expert in the field. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, in defense of you, I hope you don't mind, but I know you were speaking of historical fact when you mentioned Hitler, and you know, I had nothing to do with it.
Well, I just said that's when the drug was invented. And he used it. I mean, I might have accounted for some of his disability. I think that you know, probably the same could have been true of anything else. But
that's not to put down. Like he was. Uncomfortable or something, you know, and he was just angry, you know, and what I extracted from him, and he unfairly attacked you, and I just, you know, but I believe, you know, listening to you all the time, I really enjoy listening to you. I think you talk from the heart and not from the mind. That's important, and, you know, I just think you're a great guy, and you don't mean any harm when you talk to some of you, you know.
Hopefully not. Hopefully not. Dan, thank you for your kind words. I appreciate it, and thanks for
the
call. From one Dan to another, Dan in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Dan.
Hello, Tom.
Yeah.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak.
Sure.
I'm afraid of monopolies. Government.
So am I.
Or corporate. And also, I was wondering, do you remember the nonprofit, what was it, Blue Cross?
Blue Cross and Blue Shield. Actually, they're separate corporations for a long time. Blue Shield provided hospital coverage, and Blue Cross provided doctor coverage back when I was young, you know.
Yeah, they were nonprofit,
corporations. They were, yes.
Yeah, and they ended up getting sold to corporates.
What happened was the various states, I think it happened in Michigan in the 1980s. I don't know when it happened in different states, but it was state laws, state by state, that required health insurance providers to be not-for-profit companies. And the insurance industry was successful in getting states to change those laws. So there may still be some states where Blue Cross Blue Shield are not-for-profit. I don't know, but I don't think so.
They got a freeze on it. They can't bring any more people in, but the people that are there are locked in.
Yeah, but I think your original point, Dan, about monopolies was that you were concerned about single-payer health care nationwide. You know, Bernie Sanders has raised... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Lack of competition, either through government. Government can be a monopoly or a corporate monopoly. They're both scary to me.
Yeah, I don't disagree, but let's take two examples. First of all, to address your concern with regard to health care, Bernie Sanders suggests, I think he's onto something, frankly, even though it's not, you know, the thing that I'm the most in favor of, he's slowly winning me over to it, that instead of having a national health care, we should have national Medicare program. That is, each state should come up with their own statewide health insurance program that is subsidized in part by the federal government and in part by the state. And that way the states can kind of compete in terms of who can figure out the best way to do it. And I think there's something to be said for that. That's a pretty reasonable idea. But with regard to monopolies, consider, for example, your water supply. I'm guessing you probably have a municipal water supply.
No, I'm on a well.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, you're the exception, Dan, and I've had wells before, and they're fine things. But, you know, most of us, I live here in Portland. We have a municipal water supply. And when everybody in the community is using the product, and the product is administered not by a for-profit corporation who has its headquarters in some other state that you know, where we can't talk to the CEO and we never get an opportunity to have our voice heard, but instead is administered by local elected officials who have to answer to we the people. Then that utility gets run well, and it gets run at a decent price. And we've seen this in the United States for the better part of 200 years now with fire departments, police departments, water departments, roads. I mean, there's no end to it. They're all monopolies, but they're all run by governments in a way that makes them accountable to we the people, and that's the key to it.
Well, there's another way. Let's take the post office, for example. Post office isn't shipping all our goods. And they even started as a competition back in the stagecoach and wagon trains.
Well, the post office actually preceded the stagecoach. The post office came along in the early 1700s, before this country was even a country. And
yeah,
and Ben Franklin was the first postmaster of the United States, and that was, I think, before Wells Fargo was in business. I may be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it was.
But
it was certainly long before Lewis and Clark could come out west.
Right now they compete with UPS and
sure,
the FedEx and everything else. Hey,
yeah,
I would love the federal government
thing
to compete, and the state government to compete with medical insurance. I would love it.
And I'm not suggesting, I know that there are some countries that have national health programs where they make it illegal for health insurance companies to compete with them, and I would not want that in the United States. I agree with you, Dan, and I think that, you know, some variation on it like that. But also the post office, while it's an essential service, isn't something that keeps us alive, like our water supply, where we used to have huge cholera epidemics in the United States that would wipe out, you know, thousands of people, or our healthcare system that literally keeps us alive. It's designed to keep us alive. But still, I'm not disagreeing with you. I think that, you know, I'm not calling for a ban on health insurance companies. I'm in favor of something. I'm not against something. I'm not saying that health insurance companies should be put out of business. I'm saying that the government should be the healthcare company of first recourse for everybody. And then if people want a fancier plan, they want a plan that's going to fly them to India for a particular type of Ayurvedic treatment or something like that, let them buy it. You know, buy it in the free market.
I just went and bought health insurance, catastrophe health insurance this year. And up here in Washington, I want to be able to choose my doctor, so HMOs were out. I only had three insurance companies to be able to choose from. Mm-hmm. And one of them is not even the largest one in the world. So there is they've already chopped up the states on lack of competition, and that's one of the
reasons
why.
Well, that's because the insurance industry and Major League Baseball are the only two industries in the United States that have an exemption from the federal antitrust laws, and that's wrong. That's something that should be done away with. That's also something that Congressman Peter DeFazio has been working on. Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Eileen in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Eileen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for your show. You're great.
Thank you.
I'm calling because about 8 years ago I was insured under the Oregon Health Plan, and at this time I was taking care of my mother who had Alzheimer's, so I only worked part-time, mm-hmm. and I didn't have insurance. And I could go into the HMO with pain in my back, and they said there was nothing wrong with me, and they wouldn't refer me for diagnostic tests or physical therapy or anything. And they kept giving me samplers of antidepressants. And now, 8 years later, I'm on Medicare with chronic pain because I had three herniated discs, which continued to rupture while I was being denied treatment.
Oh, man. I know at least a half a dozen people who have gone in with serious physical problems ranging from an infection of the urinary tract to a lung problem to a back problem where they were all offered Prozac. I mean, it's amazing.
Well, the Oregon Health Plan spent millions on Prozac and Paxil, but they were refusing to treat patients who were really sick.
Well, see, this is why it needs to cover everybody, because when you have a program that covers everybody, you don't have a small cohort, a small group of people who are getting the insurance, and they're the low income and the people who are the most disenfranchised, and so they have the softest voice in the state capitol. When you have everybody covered by the state health program, then everybody's going to speak out, and no politician is going to support a program that does what the Oregon Health Plan did to you, Eileen.
Well, and the HMOs, like, they say they want to have everybody under the same roof so that they get the best care, blah blah blah, but they just really want well insured people.
That's right. They want to cherry pick the healthy and like that. Eileen,
yeah.
Good point. Thank you very much. I've got to move along. Bill in Pittsburgh. Hey Bill, what's up?
Boy, do I have a bone to pick with you.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. You know what? You're a loser. You know what, Tom?
Bill, let me put you on hold for just a minute, okay? We've got the machine just started and I can't stop it. Hang on just a second, Bill. We'll pick this up on the other end of the break. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Bill's going to pick a bone with me when we come back here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
They love Duga and hate the French. It don't really have to make sense. Fox News is a tabloid. Misinformation from a mindless boy. A great American trapezoid. Fox News is a tabloid.
And welcome back to the radio support group of by and for we the people of the United States of America. In just a second, we're going to be talking to Victoria Jones. First, we just have to wrap this up. Bill, you said you had a bone to pick with me. Can you make it really fast?
I'm going to nominate you for president for the nation of sheep.
Okay. Why?
What was his name? I know his last name is Miller, who wrote the book. You know, I still have the original copy, Tom.
And I don't know what you're talking about, Bill.
It's called The Nation of Sheep, the book.
Oh, yeah, years ago. You're talking about 2-3 decades ago.
I'm talking 1960s.
Yeah.
Anyhow, Tom, you mentioned you had been in, by the way, I like you, but I'm not going to take it from you, Tom. You have been in Europe. My question is, I didn't call from either yet. Question, couple of them. How can I buy Canadian health insurance?
You can't.
Two, you were in Europe, I understand. And would you please explain to us listeners the compare them and why it is better to go with one plan?
Sure. I would be glad to, Bill. Thank you very much. And yes, I lived in Germany for a year, and I used their health insurance system, and I've worked in England over short periods of time, and I have used their health care system on two occasions, and both worked just fine. Victoria Jones, you used to live in England.
I certainly did.
How's the health care system there?
Well, it had its faults. It's slow and it's bureaucratic, but then so is the system over here. But it works.
Yeah, everybody's covered.
Everybody's covered. That's the main thing. If you're sick, you go and see a doctor. You're covered.
Yep. Same thing in Germany. In fact, in Germany, we never had even the slow problem. I mean, call up and see the doctor. I'd like to make an appointment. Fine, tomorrow. You know, it was that kind of thing.
Oh, that's fabulous. No, I must say, in terms of getting an appointment, that wasn't too bad because I was visiting my dad recently, and he needed several appointments, and we were able to get him in every single time. It's when you get to specialists that tend to be delayed, but when you're going to see your regular doctor, no, you can get straight in.
Yeah, okay. So what's up in Washington, D.C. today?
Snow, ice.
Sleep. You know, the president just had a news conference, and I understand he laid a few eggs.
Yes, he did. You know, one thing that he said struck me as very interesting. It's not striking anybody else. And that is when he said that we don't know whether the head leaders of Iran ordered the Quds force to do what they did. In other words,
you're talking about his reply to Ed Henry's question.
Right, in terms of getting these deadly IEDs to networks inside of Iraq. Now, as you know, we've had several different stories. We've had Tony Snow saying one thing, then saying another thing. We've had Chief of Staff Peter Pace saying one thing, and we've had the low-level anonymous briefers over the weekend saying another thing. But then he went on to say that it didn't really matter whether the order was coming from the top or not, and he didn't really know if it was better or worse if it was coming from the top or not. Well, I think it does matter whether it's coming from the top or not, and I think it's highly significant if it is or if it isn't coming from the top. If the Quds force...
It's a world of difference.
Exactly. Why are we being told it doesn't matter?
Right. It's like, you know, the plastic explosive that was used in Spain or the dynamite that was used in Spain to blow up that train. If it was manufactured in the United States, does that mean Spain should be attacking us? You know, maybe if George Bush gave the order to hand that dynamite to the guys who blew up the train, but if it was just a company in the United States who happened to make it, they sold it into the international arms trade. Some guy, you know, that nobody's ever heard of who's based out of Dubai or something bought the stuff and then sold it in the black market in Spain. You know, they got no gripe with us.
I mean, in this case, the Quidspost is in the Parliament, you know, it does have power, all this kind of thing. But what it could mean is it could mean it's on the ascendant. It could mean that other forces within the government are on the descendant. Well, that's important intelligence. That's the kind of thing that actually is intelligence that we might want to know. Something that apparently they don't pay any attention to.
And there's also the issue of the fact that the Iranians and the Iraqis have a bilateral relationship. They have a mutual defense pact. They have a relationship with each other. And it may well be that the Iraqi government has been buying weapons from Iran, and this might be part of it.
It's a possibility.
I mean, we don't know. It's who knows? Or it could be factions within the Iraqi government, but that's probably more likely because it almost increasingly seems like there's no such thing as the Iraqi government. So but Bush wouldn't answer the question, and then, you know, Ed Henry was really trying to pin him down. In fact, in the next hour, I will play the audio of this. And Bush, his answers were just going around in circles. He was like, you think I'm trying to start a war with us? You know, it's like, what?
It was quite extraordinary. That was one of the highlights of the press conference, quite honestly.
Yeah,
A press conference in which he managed to say very little.
Yeah.
Not
you think, you, and he held the press conference. Do you think that the timing of the press conference had to do with the disastrous weather? You mentioned that yesterday.
Well, the fact that most of the press couldn't get there, that being the theory.
Seems like most of them showed up, though.
People did show up. I mean, people. I actually had a gig at a radio station today, so I wasn't able to be there, sadly, although he wouldn't have taken a question. People were able to get there. No, I don't think it had anything to do with the weather. There's been a rumor among the press corps that there's been going to be one for the last week, and in fact, a question was asked about it yesterday, whether there was going to be one towards the end of this week, and Tony sort of smiled but wouldn't answer the question. So it was time, because we didn't have one in January.
Yeah. Ed Henry, what assurances can you give the American people that the intelligence this time will be accurate? Bush, Ed, we know the weapons are there.
Yeah, we know.
What kind of answer is that?
Yeah, well, we knew that Saddam Hussein had weapons, too.
Yeah, right. Amazing. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thank you for the report from Washington, D.C. today.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. It's 56 minutes past the hour. Coming up in the next hour, Jonathan Moreno, the senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, Mind Wars, Brain Research, and National Defense. Larry Scott will be with us from VAWatchdog.org. We may have a report from Jane Hampshire, our blogger at the Scooter Libby trial. We'll see if sometimes she just can't get out at the times that we're on the air, depending on what's going on in the trial. And more of the news of the day and your telephone calls. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, you know, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you don't know what you know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and as Don Rumsfeld would point out, it's what you don't know, as we saw in his example, it's what you don't know that'll get you, and sometimes even everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync, and think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment is sponsored by theliberalstore.com. Be sure to have the THE in there. All things liberal in bumper stickers, buttons, T-shirts, and more. Check out the liberal teddy bear there now. That's www.theliberalstore.com. com. Jonathan Moreno is with the Center for American Progress, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and the author of Mind Wars, Brain Research and National Defense, AmericanProgress.org, the website. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom.
This is a rather mind-boggling book, Brain Research and National Defense. Give us the premise, the overall, kind of the big picture of the book first.
Well, Tom, the big picture is the question, what, given the great advances in the brain sciences that actually you can read about pretty much every day in the popular press, what are the kinds of things that the national security establishment is interested in the brain that might give us an advantage over our adversaries? And then I ask a secondary question that people of a certain age can relate to. How does all this work come out of the scandals of the 1950s and 60s, especially you may remember the LSD experiments that the CIA did in the 50s?
A good friend of mine who's on the board of a charity with me was he was at MIT and he was a starving student, and they came along and said, you know, would you be part of this experiment? They paid him, and they gave him pretty massive doses of LSD. It took him a fair number of years to really recover from it.
Is that right?
Well, because it was a controlled bad trip. You know, they gave him a nightmare experience while he was tripping, which is I think, you know, it induced PTSD.
Well, we know that there was one suicide associated with the MKUltra program that the CIA did, and we know that there was at least one death of a psychiatric patient in New York in an experiment in '53 that involved mescaline derivatives. But I
read in the paper last week that Jose Padilla was given LSD as part of his interrogation.
Well, you know, this is a question that a number of journalists have raised with me. In fact, somebody from the print media just earlier today raised this question. And, you know, we don't actually know, and this is one of the problems with the unclear legal status of those detainees, as they're called. We don't know exactly what's going on with them with respect to research. And if they were under the normal research protections, there would have to be ethics review of any experiment. But it may be that the kinds of things that are being tried, like perhaps the drugs in the interrogations there, are not considered to be experiments. So they're really not brought within the ambit of the normal rules.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a matter of concern, as I was saying to this person earlier, because, you know, once you kind of open up the options that authorities have to try something new with one population, it gets to be a little too easy to move to the next population.
Right.
So I think.
Go ahead.
No,
well, I was just wondering how far we've gone down this road. You're talking about mind wars. There are, you know, I mean, I've heard about things like governments. I mean, back during the Cold War, the Soviet Union experimenting with things like low frequency radiation or subaudible sounds that they were inflicting on entire villages in East Germany just to see what would happen. You know, is that the kind of stuff that the U.S. government is into? I mean, where are we going with this? And is this the kind of thing that at some point could be or even has been turned on U.S. civilian populations now that in the last year this amendment to the military appropriations bill in the fall did away with posse comitatus, and so now it's possible for the U.S. military to turn their attentions to we the people of the United States, which has been illegal since 1871.
This Northern Command question. You know, I don't believe that any of those ELF, low-frequency or microwave radiation efforts on either side in the Cold War came to anything. There are a lot of people, as you well know, Tom, who don't agree. There are many people who believe that they themselves are victims of mind control experiments, and I'm in touch with a lot of those people, but I don't think that that's the case. And I think a lot of what happened in the Cold War was I believe disinformation. That is to say, we were trying to get the Soviets to spend money on things like figuring out how Uri Geller could bend spoons with his brain.
Right. In fact, he was doing it as a magic trick.
Yes, it was a magic trick. So we did in fact get them to spend a lot of money, and there is a literature. Some of it's been translated from Russian, from the 60s and 70s, and it shows that they did a lot of made a lot of these efforts. I don't think any of this came to anything at all. But what modern neuroscience is able to do is kind of moving us in the direction of being able to, if you like, read minds. For example, there are some people who study what's called neuroeconomics. They do brain imaging of people while they're in some kind of a bargaining situation. And some of these folks say that they can tell in advance what decision you're going to make if you're in some kind of bargaining context. So
sure.
There are some people who believe, also some neuroscientists looking to believe, that they can tell what number you're thinking of if you're an imaging machine. There are some who believe they can tell the difference between a homosexual brain and a heterosexual brain. Now, I don't know how much of this is going to pan out, but there's no question that we're moving in the direction of learning a lot more about the physical basis of our thoughts. And that does raise, down the road, I think not so much now, but down the road, it's going to raise really serious questions, for example, about prior restraint. Like in the movie Minority Report. Remember
right.
that idea?
We
that,
know you're going to commit a crime in the future, so we're going to put you in jail right now.
That's right. And so unlike the standard figure, these sort of mind reading devices, so-called, you know, these machines that supposedly can tell if you're lying or not, these clunky lie detectors, there's real stuff that's going to be coming down the pike that really does raise some serious questions about how much the legal system should incorporate scientific information, or whether the price that could be paid from losing this level of privacy would be too high, even if it might prevent some proportion of crimes from being committed.
Mm. So where are we at, both in terms of the progress that the military is making? We're talking with Jonathan Moreno. He's the author of a new book called Mind Wars, Brain Research and National Defense. Where are we in this spectrum of research and work in terms of the U.S. military? What have they actually put on the table? What are they actually using that perhaps we should be alarmed about? And where might we be going with this? And is this something that should be under the purview of our legislature?
Well, there are so many things that are possible that I don't even have time to talk about.
Yeah, but we only have about 2 minutes
here. So let me give you one example.
Okay.
There is a lot of interest in brain-machine interfaces. The idea that with some electrodes, wirelessly, your brain can move, say, a cursor on a computer screen.
Sure.
And perhaps a machine in the next room.
Right, or a prosthetic hand.
Exactly. Example.
I mean, there's some good uses for this.
Excellent uses. My mother, as I wrote in my book, is an amputee, 50 years of her right arm and shoulder. She's never been able to use a prosthetic device, but with this research, she might be able to, or somebody in her situation might be able to. In fact, people are using them now. But what's the long range? The long range implication is essentially a robot army, an army of machines that could be controlled from a distance, from thousands of miles away, by guys in bunkers who are themselves in a virtual reality environment that recreates the circumstances of that those machines find themselves in on the
battlefield. Well, don't we have that to a certain extent right now, the way our fighter pilots,
projected
on the screen?
The Mars rover technologies kind of getting there. So, yeah, now you and I are not going to live to see this, but the robot army of the future is more than just a fantasy. It is a possibility. And what that will mean for warfare, what that will mean for our advantages over adversaries, how long we can retain those advantages. And those are questions that are coming down. And I think we do need to have a combination of scientists and historians and ethicists and lawyers starting to look at this.
Yeah, yeah. Is our military still, you know, basically playing with drugs and things like that?
Well, there's not any good evidence that there is any interest in hallucinogens now, but some stuff that's available commercially is being used to replace more traditional drugs. For example, instead of giving people amphetamines to keep them up for a long time, which we know that doesn't really work so well if you've ever taken speed, there are new drugs like one called modafinil that's been used for a while for people who have narcolepsy. Right. And it's very promising for people who need to stay awake for days at a time and retain their attention.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting. Jonathan Moreno, he's the author of a new book, Mind Wars, Brain Research and National Defense. It raises a lot of, frankly, in more questions than, you know, and I think that was your goal, more questions than answers.
True.
Very thoughtful. Senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org as well. Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. Take care.
You too. 16 minutes past the hour. for peace. How about a change in America? Welcome back. Listener-supported radio here on the Tom Hartman program, supported by you, our listeners, listening carefully for the advertisers on your local radio station and letting them know that you're listening and buying their products or patronizing them, telling your friends about them. And, of course, our national sponsors as well, like SacredGroundsCoffee.com, all organic, all fair trade. SacredGroundsCoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, SmallDog.com, The Organic Wine Company, 1-888 Eco Wine, and Purina One Natural Blends, 1-866-380-MEOW, the telephone number. 22 minutes past the hour, Larry Scott, the chief cook and bottle washer over at VAWatchdog.org, on the line with us. Hey, Larry.
Hello again, Tom.
I was shocked. Actually, shocked is probably the wrong word. I was saddened. You know, it was not unexpected to see that in the budget that Bush submitted to Congress, he was basically suggesting that he would be cutting veterans benefits and that he wasn't planning at all for all the vets who are going to be coming back from his little adventure in the Middle East.
Those are the projections for the next few years. We've got we've got a little bit of an increase coming up for 2008 that Congress is working on now. But the figures out of the White House show 2009, a major cut, 2010, a major cut, and then flat projections from there on out. It can't be done. Just can't be done. And I think this gives us a good look at what this administration thinks of veterans and where they're going. The Veterans Administration, the VA, cannot operate with any kind of a cut, much less a flat budget.
Yeah, and the chairman of the former chairman, the Republican who was up until this last election, the chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, Stephen Boyer, is continuing to trash veterans.
He is,
or let's say, pat them on the head. You know, you guys just calm down, just you know.
Right. Boyer is extremely good at this. You know, he's a very pugnacious person. He's very, very disrespectful. We're looking at a budget that is going to leave the VA terribly underfunded, and yet what Boyer does is he just toes the party line. He says things like this budget will allow veterans to receive all the care they need and lead full lives. He listened to some testimony from some veterans groups the other day before the House Committee on Veterans Affairs, and his comment was, these groups here do not represent all veterans. We'll get other input later. He talks about the backlog in claims. Over 600,000 veterans are waiting for their claims to be processed by the VA. And what they need is more people to process these claims. And Boyer says things like, throwing money at the problem is not the answer. Well, what is the answer? They need to hire more people. So we get that.
Right.
And we also have this coming from the Senate side as well, and that is Senator Larry Craig, the Republican of Idaho, who up until this last election was chairman of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. He's doing the same thing. He's actually trying to redefine, and we see this a lot now, redefine what the VA system is. And yesterday in testimony before the Senate, Craig called the VA an affordable health care system. Now, he did this while pushing brand new enrollment fees that are being proposed by the White House, as well as higher prescription copays. So what we see now is coming from the Republican side, Craig, Boyer, and others, a reframing of what the VA health care system is. It's affordable health care. As a matter of fact, in a press release, Senator Craig actually compared the VA to an HMO. And he compared veterans to employees of Boise Cascade from his home state of Idaho who have to go out and buy health care. Well, the VA is not an HMO, and veterans are not employees of a company that have to subscribe to an HMO. But this is a very, well, I should say probably not so subtle reframing that we're seeing on Capitol Hill now, Tom.
Yeah, and their health care is really part of the compensation that they got for becoming veterans. If you're willing to go out there and get shot at, put your life on the line, give a couple of years of your life to your country for, frankly, lousy pay, then, you know, having access to health care, particularly if it's related to a service-related disability, that's the deal we made.
That was the deal.
Craig wants to change it.
Senator
Larry Craig.
They're reneging on the deal. What they're saying is basically there's not enough money here. We really can't afford this. And because other people have to pay, then veterans should pay as well.
I wonder if we did away with the staff in Larry Craig and Stephen Boyer's office and then said, you know, when they start complaining they can't get anything done, say, well, you know, throwing money at things doesn't solve problems.
I like that idea. I think you might make a couple enemies on Capitol Hill with that one, though, Tom.
Yeah. We've got 20, 30 seconds left. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org. Other top news here affecting veterans?
There really is, and that is we have a really kind of a sad story about the data loss again. Over a 500,000 veterans' personal information, as well as the information of 1.3 million doctors, disappeared on a portable hard drive. The real question now is, what was this VA employee doing with a portable hard drive? They don't need to back up their data. That's all stored on VA server computers. So the big question is, why did they have this portable drive, and how did it disappear?
Yeah, and time will tell.
Here we go.
Yeah, indeed. Larry Scott, keeping track of the VA, VAWatchdog.org, the website, and keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to. Larry, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
Working two jobs ends, never seen me. Often goes hungry, so babies can eat. Fatherless son wears torn clothes to school. Making fun of him, the only golden rule. She doesn't know she's a favorite daughter. If someone wants to help her, walk on water.
And welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination.
Or at least, you know, a clean election system, national health care, clean air and water, peace in the world. We would settle for peace in the world. That would be a really great start. Let's start talking about peace instead of war. Peace is not the absence of war. I know George Bush thinks it is, but it's not. Peace is a positive force. The Republicans are figuring out that this is, the poll yesterday, the Gallup poll, 70% of Americans are going to hold their elected official responsible in 2008 for how they vote on the Iraq situation. Right? Wait until it becomes the Iran situation. So Steny Hoyer posts this letter on his website for his Republican buddies. The letter says, "We are writing to urge you not to debate the Democratic Iraq resolution on their terms, but rather on ours." This is a Republican letter. I mean, Steny Hoyer is like outing them on it. He's a Democrat. The Republicans write, "Democrats want to force us to focus on defending the surge, making the case that it will work and explaining why the president's new Iraq policy is different from prior efforts and therefore justified. We urge you to instead broaden the debate to the threat posed to Americans, the world, and all unbelievers by radical Islamists. We would further urge you to join us in educating the American people about the views of radical Islamists and the consequences of not defeating radical Islam in Iraq." You see, before we showed up, there, for all practical purposes, wasn't any radical Islam in Iraq. Unlike Saudi Arabia, they didn't have the morality police. Anyhow, it goes on to say, "The debate should not be about the surge or its details. The debate should not even be about the Iraq war to date. Mistakes have been made. Whether we can or not win militarily, if the Democrats force us into a debate on the surge or the current situation in Iraq, we lose." Indeed. Well said. Aha. Is Jane on the line? Great. Jane Hampshire is with us, firedoglake.com from the Scooter Libby trial. Hey, Jane.
Hey, how are you doing today, Tom?
Just great. What's happening at the Scooter Libby trial?
Well, they just got done arguing before the judge as to whether they're going to drag Tim Russert back or not. And the judges said they're not, which means the trial is probably going to end tomorrow, and it'll be going to the jury next Tuesday.
So the defense made their case yesterday and today. What was the essence of the defense's? Just for our listeners, Jane Hampshire has been blogging from the Scooter Libby trial over at firedoglake.com on her blog. And you've been attending the trial throughout here. What was the essence of the defense case?
Well, basically, there are four witnesses who really leave Scooter in trouble. There's Judith Miller, there's Ari Fleischer, and there's Matt Cooper and Tim Russert. The Judy Miller, the Ari Fleischer, and the Matt Cooper are a little loosey-goosey. You can kind of impeach them, but the Russert one is very, very hard. You know, it just sounds like that just wasn't the conversation that Tim Russert had with Louis Libby. He didn't tell him Valerie Plame worked at the CIA, so the Libby defense team really knows that they have to try and take as big a whack at Russert as they can. And it's kind of boiled down to minutia now because Russert at one point said, you know, he didn't know that it was any different, that he could have an attorney if he appeared before the grand jury, which he didn't. He appeared before Fitzgerald privately with his attorney. And they dug up some clip from the Clinton era where Russert admitted he knew that you couldn't have an attorney before the grand jury, and they were arguing tooth and nail to be able to get this in today.
On something that's somewhat unrelated to this case, they're trying to reduce the credibility of Tim Russert.
Exactly. They're putting the media on trial. And the judge said, no, this doesn't have anything to do with it. I'm not going to allow that.
Yeah, it sounds like it doesn't have anything to do with it. So the essence of the defense, then, is the original argument that Scooter Libby was just so busy he forgot.
I think it's more at jury nullification at this point, and Fitzgerald has said this many times. We won't know until they do their closing arguments. But essentially, they're going to try and prove that Ari Fleischer, was involved with the outing of Valerie Plame. She wasn't charged. Carl Rove was involved. He wasn't charged. So why is poor Scooter being charged? Of course, Scooter isn't being charged with outing Valerie Plame. He's being charged with perjury, obstruction of justice, and lying to FBI agents.
Right. Which raises the question, Jane, if this case has pretty much revealed the fact that there was a criminal conspiracy among Ari Fleischer, Karl Rove, the vice president, Dick Cheney, and Scooter Libby to out a CIA agent in violation of U.S. law to do what George Bush Sr. called the ultimate act of treason or words to that effect, and bring down an entire, international CIA operation, Brewster Jennings, that was gathering counterterrorism information. If this trial has brought that information out, why are there not indictments of these people for that crime?
Well, Fitzgerald is an experienced criminal prosecutor, and he is experienced in bringing down criminal conspiracies. And the way you do that is you work your way up the ladder. You get the little guy, charged with whatever you can get him on, in this case, perjury, obstruction of justice, and false statement. And hopefully, Libby will be...
But you try to roll them over.
He's going to try and roll them. That's what he does.
You think he's going... But he hasn't rolled over Scooter Libby so far, so you think that if he gets a conviction that maybe he'll try to cut a deal with Scooter before the sentencing phase?
I don't know. It depends on how successful... I think Ted Wells, Scooter's attorney, is already thinking... appeals, and he's already said so. He said so in his, first day of court.
Well, and Bush today in his news conference refused to say that he wouldn't pardon Scooter Libby.
Yeah, and I think that they're hoping that they can have 2 years of appeals, and at the end of it, Scooter, loyal apartheid, he may very well get a pardon. I don't know.
Yeah, amazing. Jane, thank you for the report. Anything I'm missing here and the questions I'm asking you, anything you want to share with us beyond that?
Well, I think Tuesday should be a really interesting day. We'll get closing arguments, Fitzgerald, again, with Fitzgerald versus Wells, and we'll really see them wrap up the cases, and I think we'll get to see some very interesting courtroom theatrics. So I invite everybody to join us for live blogging that on Fire Dog Lake.
Cool. FireDogLake.com, Jane Hampshire. Jane, thanks a lot for sharing with us.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
And we will talk with you again next week or later in the week as this continues. Great. It's 41 minutes past the hour, 866-440-8466, our telephone number. Ron in Ransom, Washington. Hey, Ron, what's up?
On the hospital or medical health care deal.
Sure, back to our first hour here.
Yeah, Washington Post on the business section, an article by Steve Perlstein an article about the McKinsey Global Institute and what they put together as far as the costs.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's at fault, and nobody wants to give up their profits. And basically that's, what it all boils down to, Everything from the doctor, all the way up to the CEO, they all want to make profits.
Right, but there's a whole bunch of people who are in this process who are not providing health care. I mean, that's the bottom line.
In
Medicare, the people who are not providing health care is a very small number of green eye shade, basically kind of CPA types who are making sure that the money is being paid out right. And the total cost to them, these boring civil servants, is 3% of overhead. In the health insurance industry, it's 30% of overhead because you've got a bunch of people who are not providing health care. Instead, like the Frist family, they're simply making billions.
Yeah, take a look at that article. I think your guest earlier, if he had read this, I mean, he wouldn't have had any argument at all, which his argument didn't really make any sense anyway. So
yeah, we'll track it down. Ron, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Eva in Vashon. Hey, Eva.
Good morning. Hey, the things they do in our name with our money, amazing. My husband and I were watching a program the other day. Well, they did an interview with a young fellow who wrote the Blackwater book. And I'm wondering, I have two questions. One is, why is that not, I believe that's done with our money without our knowledge, doing, you know, activities in the world. And apparently, you know, Rove and Cheney are connected to this group, and as well as some other people that were mentioned, Far Christian Right. And I'm wondering why that isn't being brought up in, you know, no, you can't send 20,000 troops, or this private mercenary group. They're doing things in our name with our money.
It is being looked into. Henry Waxman is looking into this stuff right now. There are 52 separate investigations of going on right now in Congress. Probably fewer than 3 or 4 of them have even been reported on, but the Democrats right now are holding 52 separate investigations of what's going on with this administration. I suspect that they're going to find something, because there's a lot of, it's just like stuff's laying around on the ground, like what you just pointed out.
So thank you. I'm so glad to hear that. We couldn't sleep. We couldn't believe this is being done. But my other question is this true that the Bush family has bought about over 100,000 acres in Paraguay on top of the world's largest aquifer? I saw it on the Internet. And
yeah. I've read that story, and the one of the Bush twins was down there, you know, a few months ago. I've seen that story in a half a dozen places, and a number of people have forwarded it to me. None of them so far have been sources that I could authenticate, so I frankly don't know. It wouldn't surprise me. The Bush family owns, you're welcome, Eva. The Bush family owns land all over the world. I mean, it's a dynasty. This is a company who, between them and their business associates, have had over $1 billion transferred to them just from the Saudis over the last 30 years. I mean, this is a dynasty that goes back to Prescott when he was dealing with the Nazis. So it's conceivable, but, I don't know. time will tell. We'll share a clip with you from Bush's news conference when we come back right after this break and continue taking your calls. 45 minutes past the hour.
I know you said, can't you just get over? It turned my whole world, and I kind of like it.
And welcome back to The Pillow. We'll help you escape the matrix. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, I just want to... Today is Al Franken's last day broadcasting live on Air America Radio, and I just want to wish him well. I'll be filling in for him. I'll be replacing him. This program, actually, is not going to change. It's going to continue. But many of the affiliated stations, many of the radio stations that were carrying Al in this day part at noon to 3 Eastern time, 9 to noon Pacific time, will be carrying this program, our program, now that Al's leaving Air America. I've been syndicated with Air America for a little over a year and a half now. And in a way, kind of, you know, competing with Al's show, I suppose, or just, you know, we're on different radio stations, sometimes on the same stations at different times. But in any case, I just want to wish Al well and thank him for being a good guy and a, you know, he's just big shoes to fill. He's going to check in with the show from time to time as long as we play Grateful Dead music, so I'm going to have to start tracking some of that down. And wish him well on his run for the Senate, assuming that that's, I believe he's announcing it pretty much right now as we speak. So, good on you, Al, and good luck. Godspeed. George W. Bush at the news conference, Ed Henry comes after him and, you know, essentially says, come on. You know, we, you know, what's the deal here? Is it true? I mean, General Peter Pace, this is the top military official in the United States, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He says that there's no evidence. He has not seen any evidence that the Iranian government, quote, quote, clearly knows or is complicit, end quote, in weapons smuggling into Iraq. So Ed Henry asks George Bush about this. The top military guy, your top military guy says, we don't have any evidence of this. Here's Bush and Ed Henry.
Yes, sir. President, I want to follow up on Iran one more time. You saying today that you do not know if senior members of the Iranian government are in fact behind these explosives, that contradicts what U.S. officials said in Baghdad on Sunday. They said the highest levels of the Iranian government were behind this. It also, it seems to square with what General Pace has been saying, but contradicts with what your own...
Let me finish.
So this is really interesting, because this gets back to the New York Times stories and all the other wire service stories over the weekend that, you know, Iran is supplying these weapons and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then Pace comes out and says, well, we don't know that Iran... I mean, they might have been manufactured there, but we don't know that the Iranians are supplying them. And then Bush comes out and says, well, you know, we don't know for sure that it's Iranians. He's sort of agreeing with Pace, and now he contradicts himself.
I can't say it more plainly. There are weapons in Iraq that are harming U.S. troops because of the Quds Force. And as you know, I hope, that the Quds Force is a part of the Iranian government. Whether Ahmadinejad ordered the Quds Force to do this, I don't think we know. But we do know that they're there, and I intend to do something about it.
Oh, yeah?
And I've asked our commanders to do something about it, and we're going to protect our...
Some of those contradictions, Mr. President.
There's no contradiction that the weapons are there and they were provided by the Quds Force.
What assurances can you give the American people that the intelligence this time will be accurate?
Ed.
Now, notice he's not going to answer this question.
No, they're there.
We know
they're provided by the Quds Force. We know the Quds Force is a part of the Iranian government. I don't think we know who picked up the phone and said the Quds Force go do this. Well, we know it's a vital part of the Iranian government. What matters is that we're responding. The idea that somehow we're manufacturing the idea that the Iranians are providing IEDs is preposterous, Ed. My job is to protect our troops.
Oh, he's going off on his my job again. And you know, it just this is, you know, just so much shades of...
You say we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Yeah, and then after we started the war, he said...
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program?
Nope.
And the answer is absolutely.
Nope.
And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in.
And he did.
And he wouldn't let them in.
Yes, he did.
And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power, along with other nations, so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
Yeah, incredible. Dorothy in Raymond, Washington. Hey, Dorothy.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I listened to the president, and it was rather pathetic rhetoric trying to justify a new war with Iran.
That certainly is what it sounds like is going on. In fact, it sounds like he's already decided it. I mean, occasionally speaking in the past tense.
Well, yeah. I don't know. It's maddening how... the media, I think that's the problem. The corporate media is not allowing all of material that has been found by good investigative reporters to be brought to the American people. And
no, I see. You know, Seymour Hirsch. Excuse me, Dorothy.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Seymour Hirsch. Yes. But how many people here? Them, and I'm glad that we have Air America, but
that's pretty much it, unfortunately. I mean, Seymour Hirsch was talking about this a year ago. He was saying the decision had been made a year ago. It was like the Downing Street minutes. In July of 2002, the decision was made to go to war in the spring of 2003, and sure enough, it happened.
Well, I know. It looks like he can just go ahead and do everything.
Yep, well, he certainly thinks he can. This is deja vu. Yeah, you're right. Congress is the sole source of the authority to go to war, but that's not what Bush believes. Dorothy, thanks so much for the call. Coming up on tomorrow's program, the top of the news of the day, plus the top news of the day, plus I'll be debating conservative Ivan Osorio on the Employee Free Choice Act. David Smethurst is here on the first war on terror, what Bush could learn from President Jefferson on a war on terror. That and more, and your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get active. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.